judicial circuit. Period, period, period. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
So how many of you thought you'd live to see this day? Good morning, everyone. I want to apologize for my voice and welcome you all here this morning. The first case of the day is Jeffrey Lillian versus Peak Six Investments, and it's Mr. Bueller. Good morning, Mr. Bueller. You're lucky you're all out there. Think about these two up here.
Thank you for making it in today. It sounds like you're suffering from what's going through my office.
Yeah, well.
May it please the court, my name is Terry Bueller. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Jeff Lillian. Mr. Lillian is appealing the lower court's decision granting the defendant's motion for summary judgment and dismissing all of his claims.
Mr. Bueller, I want to apologize, but before we begin, you know, we have an obligation to make sure that there's subject matter jurisdiction before we proceed. What is Mr. Lillian's state of citizenship?
Connecticut.
You know, it's not in the brief. So at the time the suit was filed, what was his citizenship?
He had moved to Connecticut at that point, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad to clear that
up. Yes, that's why we did not make an issue of diversity in the after the case was transferred to the federal
okay.
court. I would suggest to the panel that the issues, and I don't know what's doing this.
Don't worry.
Okay. The issues before you today are fairly simple. It's a straightforward case. In spring 2001, Mr. Lillian was looking to find a new job in his search brought him to Peak Six Investments.
And let me just get cut right to the yes. one of the factual questions that I have.
Yes.
What evidence in the record is there that Peak Six definitely told him that the IPO would close by the time he started?
That
I know there's
right.
some allusion to it, but
right. he was told that several times, Your Honor, and I think if I illustrate it with a chronology, it goes to the heart of the case.
All right.
In mid-April, Mr. Lillian had lunch with the two principals from Peak Six. I think we can all agree it was at a Wall Street deli. And at that time, they said plans were in place to close the IPO at the end of May, the next month. To that end, they'd hired a CFO, a guy named Ron Webster. They had filed an S-1. And so certainly, as of middle of April, the plan was to close by the end of May. The next communication, well, the next thing that happened that matters to the case, on April 25th, the CFO, Ron Webster, quits. Shortly thereafter, on May 4, Peak Six's principals, I don't remember if it was Hulsizer or Just, but one of them offered Mr. Lillian a job. And that job description included the you know, the options that are at the center of the case. And in connection with that, there was a conversation. It was, I believe, a conversation between Just and Lillian, at which time she told him everything was in place to complete the IPO by the end of May. On May 8th, Mr. Lillian had an additional conversation about the job, and that also included a discussion of the stock options and that the plan to close the IPO by the end of May.
And didn't he say in his deposition that he understood that finalizing the stock option plan was a task he might have in closing the IPO?
Yes, Your Honor.
And doesn't that show that maybe he didn't expect it to be closed by the time he started?
If not by the time... Certainly by the first couple of weeks of June. I think it was important for this company at the time. The plan was the end of May. Certainly, the roadshow might have delayed things a little bit. The pre-selling the stock. But I think what's important here is that everybody was operating under the impression that this IPO was going to close at the end of May. Certainly, up until the time Ron Webster left. That was also repeated in a conversation between Mr. Lillian and one of the Peak Six principals on May 9th when he, I think, formally accepted his job offer. And that's really what the case is all about, Your Honor, because as of May 9th, Peak Six's principals were representing to Lillian that it was going to close by the end of May, maybe early June, but not anywhere past anything past that. And at the same time, they knew two things. One, they knew that they couldn't go forward with the with their public offering until they had a CFO in place. They didn't have one. And this is where I take issue with the findings by the lower court, because the lower court made a factual determination that, in fact, Peak Six was prepared to go forward with their bookkeeper as the CFO, a woman named Sue Hendrick. And there's certainly evidence in the record of that, but there's a great deal of evidence that's contrary to that. And that's where I take issue with Judge Zagel's findings. I think he inserted himself as a fact finder, because there was a lot of evidence in the record that, in my view, showed that the company couldn't go forward without a CFO, and the company knew that. And at the same time that they had no CFO, they were telling Lillian they were going to close the IPO the end of May, maybe the first part of June.
What evidence is there that they tried to conceal the departure of the CFO from him?
I'm not sure that I would describe it as concealing. What I think happened here, Your Honor, is Mr. Webster, the CFO, was disclosed in the S-1 as the CFO. Lillian had read the S-1. He knew that they had hired Webster for that purpose. Holsizer and Just had told him they were going forward with the IPO. And then I believe the CFO's decision to leave was a material change in circumstances that created a duty on their part to tell him that. So I'm not sure I would describe it as concealing so much as a duty being created because of things that they had told him in the immediate past.
Well, what evidence is there in the record that Lillian was asking questions about the status of the IPO or the company's financial situation before he signed the offer?
His testimony that he spoke on the telephone with the principals from Peak Six. Certainly they will agree at least that he spoke on May 8th and May 9th with them in connection with the job offer. He testified that he spoke with them prior to that.
A problem that I have is that an IPO is a rather public event. Wouldn't he have known before he started working there that the IPO had not in fact closed?
Yes, Your Honor, quite right. Once again, if I can go to the chronology, he accepted the job offer formally on May 9th. He then took a trip out of the country. He came back. I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. I don't know what he did for the next 9 days, but on May 18th, he sat down with some of the lawyers from Peak Six's outside firm, and at that point, he learned for the first time that the CFO had left. At that point, he'd already walked away from his other job offer. You know, he was leaving the country shortly, and testimony is that he didn't fully appreciate how contingent the IPO was until he returned from his trip at the end of May. But you're quite right, the IPO is a public event. He knew before he started that it wasn't going forward. At that point, and this gets into the waiver argument too, certainly, but at that point, he was aware that the IPO was not going off as scheduled. Apart from the CFO leaving, the other factual change...
See, he's an employee at will. An employee at will can leave immediately.
Yes, I agree.
And it something is not making sense. In other words, it would seem, I mean, as a practical matter, why would Peak Six try to lure him into a job on grounds that immediately would be revealed to be false?
I have a suggestion on that, Judge, from the record, because I think it's a fair question. I think it's a good question. Peak Six had not given up its intention to close the IPO by the time Lillian joined them. What they had been forced to do was postpone it. And the objection here by Mr. Lillian is, if he had known how contingent the IPO was, if he had known how far in the future was going to be postponed, he would have walked away from the job. As it was, he accepted the Peak Six offer, and in so doing, he gave up the UBS offer with its block of stock.
Well, then why isn't that a calculated risk that simply didn't pay off here? Why does that become fraud?
Because, Your Honor, things change, both in terms of the financial performance, expected financial performance of the company in early May, as well as the role of the CFO in the public offering, changed between the time that they initially discussed the job with him and at the time he accepted the job, and they didn't disclose those things to him.
But when you look at what his experience level is and the information that was disclosed in the S-1 form, he was certainly aware of the dangers of market volatility and the possibility that this wouldn't come to fruition. I mean, we don't have an unsophisticated person. That's my point here.
And actually, the sophistication, I think, made it easier for Peak Six to advance this. He had read the S-1. He appreciated the strong financial. I mean, certainly there's no guarantee of future events, but by the time, by the end of April, Peak Six, the volatility in the market had dropped. Peak Six's positions had taken a substantial drop in value, and they were sitting in a situation where they could, you know, try to ride it out at the risk of having huge losses, or cut their losses and close the positions out. And while they were doing that, while they were sitting in that situation, they were telling Mr. Lillian that they were expecting another strong quarter.
Where's the evidence of the suppression of the material facts? What we seem to have here is silence.
I'm sorry, is what, Your Honor?
Silence.
Yes.
And that is normally not enough.
I think the
for fraud.
I would agree with Your Honor with this difference. Because of the importance of the CFO's position to the IPO, when he made a decision to leave, that changed what they had told him in the immediate past about the timing and the schedule of the public offering. Because that was a material change, his leaving, I believe, created a duty to disclose that information to Mr. Lillian.
But what evidence is there that the CFO's departure was linked to the delay and eventual demise of the IPO?
Several things, Your Honor. First of all, and the white light is... I'll answer this, and then unless the
sure.
panel has more. The explanation from the defendants was that they were going to use their bookkeeper as a CFO. They never offered her the title or the position. They didn't push the IPO forward with her. When they did the amended S-1 in June, they didn't list her name in the CFO position, you know, in the management section or description. When they were preparing private placement documents in June, they failed. When they listed their management people, they did not put Ms. Hendricks in as CFO. She was simply omitted. They had
none of that is evidence that the IPO was delayed because of the departure of the CFO, and eventually it didn't happen at all. But none of that was linked to the departure of this particular CFO, as I understand the evidence.
I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor. When they finally did get a CFO in place, Steve Jones in the summer of 2001, then they cranked up the IPO machinery again. I think that is evidence that the company understood they couldn't go forward without a CFO. You can't go to the public markets, and there's testimony by both sides on this, Your Honor, that you can't go to the public markets and expect a successful initial public offering without a seasoned, experienced, reputable CFO in place.
And this amended S-1, if the bookkeeper wasn't listed, who was listed as the CFO?
No one. It was blank. CFO, that blank.
So that was information that was available to your client as early as June. I understand
right.
where the timing is,
right.
but he certainly saw that in the public document.
He may actually have worked on the amended S-1, or he certainly had it at his office. Thank you.
Ms. Gottschall. May it please the Court, Julie Gottschall on behalf of the Peak Six entities. Mr. Buehler and I agree that this is a simple and straightforward case, and in fact, it's a commonplace situation that plays out in the markets every day.
Do you also agree that at the time the suit was filed, that Connecticut was the citizenship?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. This is a situation where there was an employer who was proceeding with an IPO. They looked to hire somebody. They told him that they believed that there were good things on the horizon for this company and that there was the possibility of stock options and a large bonus if you were to take employment with them. And then despite the best efforts of everybody involved, the IPO never went forward, the options were never issued, and the bonus was less than what everyone had hoped for.
Well, let's get right to the materiality issue, because what I want to try to understand is why wouldn't the CFO's resignation and financial results be material to Lillian's decision to accept the job at Peak Six?
Let me address that in a couple of different ways, Your Honor. First of all, let me talk about what's in the record on those points, and let me start with financial performance. Contrary to what Mr. Lillian has contended in his briefs and before this court, the financial issues did not come into play until after Mr. Lillian had accepted the position on May 9th. The record's very clear on this point. The only evidence is that the losses started on May 15th, and they weren't fully calculated by the company until May 25th. And there's documentary evidence to that effect as well. So this is a situation that when they were recruiting Mr. Lillian, everything was going very well. The financials were very, very strong, and it wasn't until after he'd accepted the job and left the country that that situation changed. So certainly that was not something that they could have told him about, even if they had an obligation to do so, which we contend that they do not. With regard to the CFO, as the district court properly recognized, the departure of the CFO was not a material event in terms of the IPO. What the testimony is that Webster was a very new CFO. He had only been with the company for 3 weeks, and in that sense, he was in no way indispensable to the IPO process. What the principals of Peak Six believed was that they could either find a new CFO, and they were looking at people who had been involved in the deal and could get up to speed very quickly, and in fact offered the position to one of their outside auditors in early May, or alternatively that they could go forward if they needed to with Sue Hendricks in the CFO position. And so in their minds, the departure of the CFO didn't make a difference to their IPO plans. Moreover, I'd point out that there's not even evidence in the record that the CFO's departure was subjectively material to Mr. Lillian. And he says it time and again in his brief, but there is nothing in the record where he says, if I had known that Ron Webster was no longer with Peak Six, I would not have taken this job. It's not in the record. Beyond that, as we've argued in the brief, Peak Six did not have a duty to disclose to Mr. Lillian that the CFO had left. And this is where we get into the mere silence is not sufficient to show fraud argument. When they told him that they had hired a CFO, and that's all that there is in the record, is that they said, we have hired a CFO. And then subsequently he came in to interview and they showed him where the CFO was sitting. That's all they did. They didn't tout his experience or in any other way make an issue of the CFO. But that was true at that point in time. They had no advance knowledge that the CFO was going to leave. When the CFO did leave, it is true that they did not affirmatively tell Mr. Lillian that the CFO had left, but they simply had no duty to do that. Silence becomes fraud only if it is accompanied by deceptive conduct or suppression of material facts, and they certainly didn't suppress anything. They didn't hide it. Mr. Lillian simply didn't ask what the status was of the IPO or the CFO. So this is not a situation where there was any other deceptive conduct or any intent to mislead him. And that actually brings me to what is missing, a critical omission from Mr. Lillian's theory here. What he has said is, I don't need to show intent to defraud. And I don't need to show, although he admits in his brief that it's a critical element, that there was a false statement of fact. All that I need to show is that they didn't tell me everything that I subjectively felt I needed to know to make an informed decision about my future employment. That is not sufficient to show fraud. There is no evidence of intent on this record, and because there is no evidence of intent to defraud him or not to go forward with the CFO, then he cannot sustain a fraud claim. And, in fact, that is what the district court properly recognized.
You fault him for staying until they terminated his employment. He claims, of course, that he was actively looking for a job nearly the entire time that he was there. Wasn't he obliged to stay there until he found something else in order to mitigate his damages?
Your Honor, that argument as well is based on a misrepresentation of the record. What Mr. Lillian has contended is that he was actively engaged in job search, and again, the record doesn't support him on that. He knew 2 weeks after accepting employment that the CFO had left, and he knew shortly after that that the IPO was postponed. He contends he started looking for a job right away, but that is not supported by the record. What is in the record is that he did not, upon learning these things, call the headhunter that he had been working with. He did not call the other employer that had offered him a job to see if that opportunity was still available. He did not work with any headhunters. What he did was passively accept phone calls from headhunters. That led to him submitting one resume in August of 2001, several months after he learned of the situation, and having an offhand conversation with a former partner of his at a law firm about possible opportunities, and that didn't occur until the fall of 2001. The case law requires that somebody who's been defrauded abandon the transaction with all reasonable diligence. Reasonable diligence would have been going out there and actively looking for a job. We're not saying that he necessarily had to leave his employment if he needed the income, but certainly if he is going to show that he exercised reasonable diligence, he has to show that he was actively involved in a job search, and the record doesn't support him on that point. And, in fact, he stayed with the company for over 7 months. It wasn't until he was involuntarily terminated that he brought these claims. I'd also like to just point out that one of the only places where we believe that the district court got it wrong was with regard to reasonable reliance. As Judge Williams has pointed out, this was an exceptionally sophisticated person who understood all of the risks inherent in an IPO, inherent in stock options, and admitted that market forces could derail the IPO, and he understood that. He admitted that he knew he was walking into a high-risk situation. And nonetheless, he didn't engage in any self-help. He didn't ask for updates as he went along, even though he was actively talking to the principals. There's nothing in there to support his contention that he asked for updates. And you will see that Mr. Lillian, he supplemented his original deposition testimony with one declaration. He then tried to add additional evidence on a motion for relief from judgment, which we contend is not properly evidenced before this court. And so he has continually tried to develop a record that simply fundamentally is not there. If there are no further questions on the fraud claim, I'll move on just briefly to the bonus issue. Here again, Mr. Lillian has somewhat changed his theory. What he argued before the district court was that Mr. Hulsizer said there was a target bonus of $150,000, and that $150,000 could go up or down depending on the firm's year. It was determined by the performance of the firm and the performance of Mr. Lillian. and that the bonus could be zero, it could be $1 million. And the district court properly found that there was not clear and convincing evidence that a promise had been made to give him a bonus of a certain amount. Mr. Lillian has now changed what his theory is. He says that there were actually two bonuses, one that was purely discretionary and one that was an absolute guarantee based solely on the firm's performance. That is not what he has argued before, and that is not in the record. The district court properly held that the full amount of the bonus was discretionary. The two offer letters presented to Mr. Lillian said that the bonus was discretionary. Human Resources told him that they would not put bonus amounts in writing. The amendment that Mr. Lillian signed off on said that the bonuses were not guaranteed, but he was only eligible for them. And when he was involved in hiring the CFO, he said that the firm couldn't guarantee any bonuses. So clearly Mr. Lillian knew that it was just a discretionary bonus. There are no questions on that. I will just conclude by saying that this is precisely the kind of situation where the courts have held that somebody took a gamble, it didn't go well, and they're looking for someone to blame. This is not a situation that supports fraud or breach of contract.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you 2 minutes.
I just have one point I want to raise. If, in fact, this was purely a discretionary bonus, then why was it a prorated amount? It would seem to me, and we can all agree, we being my opponents and I, that the amount was a prorated amount. I suggest that makes it a target. You don't prorate discretionary numbers. If the panel has no questions for me, I will rest.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, Mr. Bueller and Ms. Gottschall. Case will be taken under advisement. We're going to go on.